afternoon. My name is Latricia, and I will be a conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Center for American Progress Big Oil Goes to College conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then a number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Solner, you may begin the conference.
Thanks so much, Latricia. My name is Anna Solner, and I'm the Vice President of Communications at the Center for American Progress. I'd like to remind everyone that this call is being recorded and that audio will be available after the press call is over, probably about an hour after the session. If you need to reach me after the press conference call to reach either of our speakers, my phone number is 202-478-5322. That's 202-478-5322. Joining us today to discuss this new report is Kate Gordon, Vice President for Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress, as well as Jennifer Washburn, the report's author, who's an independent researcher and an expert on university-industry relationships. I'd like to also mention that Jennifer was the author of the 2005 book, University Inc., and is a former Academic Freedom Fellow at New York University. So with that, I'd like to kick it off with Kate Gordon.
Thanks so much, Anna, and thanks everyone for joining the call. This is a critically important report for us at this moment. The global energy market is expanding. We just found out, I think, today that China has just surpassed the United States in installed wind power and has also the largest solar manufacturing market in the world. Traditionally, the United States has really been a leader in technology on research and development and has led in the development of new technologies, including in the energy sector, but we're at risk of falling behind, in part because public research and development dollars are shrinking. R&D money for energy is only 1.6% of all federal R&D money, down from about 18% when we faced the big crisis in oil production in the late 70s and 80s. We're in the middle of another crisis right now of global warming and a global clean energy economy, and we aren't spending nearly the public dollars that we used to. As a result, the private market has really been filling in the gap, and we at CAP commissioned this report really to look at the implications of that, of private money particularly going into public universities and large research universities to fund research on cleaner energy technologies and new energy technology solutions. The report commissioned by Jennifer Washburn, who's also on the phone, looks closely at 10 agreements between universities and corporations to better understand the impact of that private funding on the public research at those universities. We had independent legal experts do an evaluation of these contracts, and we also sent our initial findings out to each of the partnerships for comment before publication and reflected their comments in our final publication. Essentially, what we found, and Jennifer will expand on this to a great extent, but essentially what we found, or Jennifer found, was that the contract language in these 10 agreements did not always adequately protect academic freedom and academic transparency, exactly the characteristics of the academy that make universities so credible for research and development, and exactly the characteristics of universities that made these corporations go to them in the first place to do the research. We, after examining the contracts at the end of the report, make a recommendation for better oversight and stronger contract language in these types of public-private partnerships with universities, especially where public dollars are being spent and especially where the research is to serve a public purpose, in this case, more and better development of clean energy technologies. And I will turn it over to Jennifer to give more detail on the specific findings in the report.
Great. Thanks a lot, Kate, and thanks to everybody who's been able to join the call. So I'm just going to try to give a brief run-through here. Essentially, in this report, we obtained and examined 10 major energy research alliance agreements between big oil and other energy-related companies and U.S. universities. And I just want to stress at the outset that the report focuses on large-scale, multi-million-dollar, multi-year research alliances between these oil firms and universities. Many of these deals are scheduled to last as long as 5, 8, or 10 years. So these alliances tend to institutionalize the university's relationship with the corporate sponsor over several years. we're seeing more and more of these large-scale alliances on campus, particularly in the area of pharmaceutical-funded research, and now also we're seeing it here with energy research. I want to just stress, too, that these large-scale alliances are quite distinct from the smaller, traditional corporate-sponsored research deals that we've seen in the past that are that usually go to fund just one research lab or one researcher. So to my knowledge, this report really represents the first time that independent analysts have systematically looked at a set of written university industry research contracts within the energy R&D sector. Specifically, we were looking at these contracts to evaluate how well do they balance the goals of the corporate sponsors to produce commercial research that advances business profits with the mission of universities, which we know is to perform high-quality, disinterested academic research that tends to advance public knowledge for the betterment of society. So obviously, in the area of public good climate research and clean energy research, it is critically important to safeguard and protect the quality and the independence of this university-based research. Much of these research, many of these research labs are extensively subsidized by, obviously, public taxpayer sources. So most of the contracts were obtained through state-level Public Record Act requests. Many universities, however, were extremely reluctant to make these industry contracts public. In one case in Texas, they forwarded our request to the Attorney General's office. Increasingly, universities consider these contracts to be corporate proprietary. I filed roughly 24 formal Public Record Act requests, and only 9 of those requests were actually filled by these state-funded universities, just to give you an indication of how low the response was. So I'm going to sum up the findings very quickly, and for those of you who are looking for this, it's largely, I'm just looking at page 5 of the report. The contracts show that universities are signing these long-term agreements with big oil and energy firms that fail to adequately protect their academic independence and their research objectivity. In 9 of the 10 energy research agreements, the university partners failed to retain majority academic control over the central governing body that's charged with directing the University Industry Alliance. In 4 of the 10 cases, the industry sponsors actually have full governance control. At Stanford, for example, all 4 of the voting seats are controlled by the 4 industry sponsors. 8 of the 10 agreements permit the corporate sponsors to fully control both the evaluation and the selection of faculty research proposals in each new grant cycle. None of the agreements that we looked at, and none of the written agreements ever actually require proposals to be evaluated and awarded funding based on independent expert peer review, which is the traditional method for awarding academic and scientific research grants. The purpose of peer review is to assure that the research is being judged fairly and impartially based on scientific merit. 8 of the 10 alliance agreements failed to specify transparently in advance how faculty should apply for alliance funding and what the specific evaluation and selection criteria would be. Given that there was no use of independent peer review in many instances, those criteria should certainly be made public. 9 of the 10 agreements also call for no specific management of financial conflicts of interest related to the alliance and its research function. None of the agreements, for example, specified that the committee members charged with evaluating and selecting faculty research proposals should be impartial and should not award corporate funding to themselves. At the UC Berkeley BP-funded Energy Biosciences Institute, I identified numerous quite serious potential conflicts of interest on the faculty executive committee that is charged with selecting faculty research proposals. In that case, many of the overwhelming majority of the faculty who sit on the executive committee are actually recipients of BP EBI funding. So I encourage you to take a look at those findings, which are somewhat buried on page 64, 65. There's a sidebar that deals with some conflict of interest concerns at the EBI. So in short, our analysis, and I'll just wrap this up, of these university industry contracts found that big oil and other large energy firms are exercising quite considerable influence and control over the university's internal research operations, and that's what concerned us. And just briefly on the methodology, I want to stress that it is very difficult to analyze, the impact of this industry funding. We do know from extensive research, particularly in the medical research arena, that industry funding of academic research is overwhelmingly more likely to favor the corporate sponsors' products and interests as compared to nonprofit or government-funded research. There's a large body of research now that shows this that I cite in the report. And so I think what the concern is here is that the same type of concern, that we want to have independent energy research looking at all of the full range of alternative energy technologies. And it's important that there be governing structures in place that encourage and facilitate that kind of independent research that we expect from universities. So I think I've reached my time. Maybe we can talk about methodology a little bit more in the Q&A.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Latricia, I believe we're ready for questions.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then a number one on your telephone keypad. The first question comes from Andrew Wasukia with the Washington Independent.
Hi, it's just Mastusha, but I just had a question. Do you guys, can you point to some specific examples, maybe, of how some of these reports may have been changed as a result of these contracts? I mean, were there actual tangible things that you can point to in the reports that show that industry may have had an influence?
You know, we really don't know. You know, we really don't know exactly where industry had an influence, but I think that if you look carefully at the appendices section of the report, there are 10 appendices, and each of them deal with a detailed breakdown of the different contracts. And here, getting into the methodology, I just want to explain that we developed a set of 17 questions, and we asked independent outside legal experts who are familiar with university industry contracts to analyze each of the contracts and determine what the legal terms of that contract would permit, to use that as the basis for answering those 17 questions. So I was really careful to recognize the fact that I am not an expert in reading legalese, but I think that you'll see in the comments from our outside legal examiners that in many cases it feels as if the agreement is largely structured to cater to the industry sponsor. You'll see this a lot with a lot of the Chevron agreements. There are specific criteria that are clearly designed to facilitate Chevron's business interests, and there's very little reciprocal language that might protect the university's interests.
And just a quick follow-up, if that's all right. When you say industry, are you just talking about the oil and gas industry, or does this extend to the renewables industry, wind, solar, other groups that have commissioned reports from universities as well?
You keep referencing reports. I just want to make clear that these are research contracts, so they would be funding, they would be funding various different types of research. And the agreements that we looked at are largely with what have been sort of traditionally termed big oil companies, but many other energy firms. But most of the companies that tend to be funding university research on a large scale seem to be the larger energy firms, the more established legacy energy companies. Undoubtedly, there is some of this other smaller and alternative energy companies, wind, solar. Undoubtedly, they're funding research as well, but most of the agreements that we look at are these larger-scale agreements that tend to be with the legacy energy companies.
Okay, thanks.
The next question comes from Brian Walsh with Time Magazine.
Hi. Do you have any sense as to whether this is getting worse? I mean, of course, we know that universities, especially state universities, are facing serious financial problems. I mean, do you have a sense that they're going to perhaps need to become or are becoming more dependent for funding on these kind of industry contracts that you're writing about?
Let me jump in, Jen, on that first, and then you can pick
sure.
it up. You know, we're clearly going into an era where public funding is going to be less and less available. The talk about the deficit, the sort of shrinking budgets for all kinds of universities at the federal and the state level, the real reluctance to do spending on research and development as well as on public universities that's coming out of Congress and some of the state houses definitely do not bode well for public funding into research and development on clean energy technology. So if the research is going to be done, and all signs point to the fact that it needs to be done, most of that money is going to come from private sources. This is a growing global market. It's projected to be a $2.3 trillion market in sales by 2020. That's probably a lowball estimate that came out a year or so ago. These companies know that this is a growing market and that they need to play in this growing market. It's very likely that more and more of these private dollars will be going into this type of research.
I'm sorry, just so I'm clear, that $2.3 trillion, that's for clean energy or that's energy more broadly?
Oh, clean energy. That's tiny compared to energy more broadly.
If I could piggyback on that just a tiny bit. I mean, I think we are also seeing, I think one thing that concerns me a little bit is we are seeing more and more of the public research dollars that are going into alternative energy research being distributed in tandem with corporate funding. And there's nothing implicitly wrong with that, but my concern is that there aren't enough safeguards. So you're seeing a lot more money out of DOE, for example, the Department of Energy, that is being dispersed through some form of public-private cost-sharing arrangement. And again, I think that there are plenty of instances where we would want to see industry and universities collaborate, and I want to make clear that I am not opposed to university-industry collaborations. I think it's critical that the energy industry overall, and I give a lot of data on this in the report, is investing an infinitesimal amount of its revenues in energy research of any kind. So the energy industry, you know, a lot of these big oil companies have gotten a lot of good publicity and press from these deals at universities, but in the scheme of things, these large oil companies are investing very little of their money in energy research, particularly any kind of alternative energy research. And so I think the federal government is kind of bending over backwards to try to incentivize industry to spend more money on research. And my concern is we just want to make sure that those public research dollars are not kind of becoming hijacked and somewhat excessively controlled by corporate interests rather than continuing to go toward the kind of cutting-edge research that we need universities to do to open up new kind of technological arenas. Obviously, the energy industry has an interest in particular technologies over others.
It's just a quick follow-up. I mean, is this somewhat, you know, are these problems, these conflicts of interest somewhat inevitable if you're going to see more and more that because there's not the will anymore, apparently, to spend public funds, the necessary public funds for this, this money has to come from private companies? I mean, is that conflict of interest almost inevitable? Are there ways to really put safeguards that avoid the problems you're talking about here?
One thing, this is Kate Gordon, one thing that, I don't think it is inevitable, and in fact, when we sent out our initial findings to the partnerships, and they responded in great part that regardless of the contract language, in practice, they were doing things much more the way that Jennifer in the report said they should be. So many of the universities responded to say, that may be what our contract says, but in fact, here's what we do for peer review, here's what we do for publication delays. That tells me that it's very easy to input those types of conditions into the contract, that you can actually have a binding legal agreement at these universities, which really is the only real governing document for the partnerships, it should be very easy to put those types of safeguards into those agreements. And when public dollars are being used or leveraged, it should be a priority to put those kinds of safeguards into the contracts. Because ultimately, what makes a partnership with a university credible is that the university has a history of academic freedom, of peer review, of publication, of open process. Those types of safeguards need to be put into the contract language and made clear as part of these formal agreements. And as we know from the universities telling us their actual practices, in some cases they're already doing it. So we're just saying get it in the contract.
I think that's right. And also, you know, I do want to stress, I mean, in 2009, the Obama administration actually did vastly increase energy research spending and certainly has had a mind toward doing that. So, and the 2009 R&D outlays really do reflect that, and I do have those figures in the report. So, you know, the other thing I want to stress is that 60% of university research is still funded by the federal government. And despite a lot of efforts on the part of universities and the federal government to encourage greater industry investment on campus, the truth is that only 6% of university research overall is actually funded by industry. So, you know, it's we do have to keep that in perspective. Universities still overwhelmingly do rely on the public research dollars. There are some estimates, however, that roughly 25% of university research is now influenced by private industry money through these public-private partnerships.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Kate Shepard with Mother Jones Magazine.
Hi, thanks for holding the call. I'm wondering if you can give specific examples of what research some of these companies were like partnering with the universities on. Are there things that they're specifically looking at that raise concerns about this funding? And then sort of part of that, have you seen a remarkable increase in those funding in recent years as the public dollars have declined?
Kate, should I take a first stab at that?
Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
I should just point out to you all the report is lengthy, and so one critical thing to look at is the summary of main findings that begins on page, I think it's 52 of the report, and that gives a brief digest of each of the deals that we look at, and you'll see that you know, we briefly try to summarize what the research focus is, and you'll see that a very large number of these deals do finance primarily biofuels-related research. I do think that is indicative of which alternative energy research technology the bigger legacy oil and energy companies seem to be favoring. I mean, the $500 million deal at UC Berkeley at the Energy Biosciences Institute, that money is almost exclusively, not entirely, but going to biofuels-related research. They're also doing some fossil fuel bioprocessing and carbon sequestration, but the bulk of it is biofuels. And, you know, we could speculate about the various different reasons why that might be more in tune with their current business model. You know, it's a conceivable that it's a fuel that could still be distributed in a similar way to the way that the oil companies currently distribute oil and gas. So, you know, sorry, I hope that's a little bit helpful. But if you look on 52, it does summarize each of the things quite quickly.
And it's Kate Gordon. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
It does make sense. I mean, these are oil companies that are trying. They're not doing public funding in universities because they want to increase the overall knowledge of the world in clean energy technology. They're doing it because they want to make a profit in clean energy technology. So it makes sense, I think, as Jen just said, that they'd be funding in an area that's very close to what they're already doing. So how do you run alternative fuels through your existing pipeline, whether that's ethanol, whether it's more advanced biofuels, algae, whatever. I think that's why we see those areas as the primary areas of research. I don't actually know the answer to your second question on whether there's been an increase in funding for research in those areas as a result. But I do know that, for instance, the Berkeley deal, which was a pretty big one with BP for the Biofuels Institute, was a very, very big deal at the time. And I believe it was the single largest commitment on biofuels research that had been made at that time. So I don't know what the overall numbers are on research funded then and now, but certainly these are big contracts, big agreements that are advancing the field of biofuels research.
And then as a follow-up question, I mean, looking at the void that's been created with government funding, I mean, are there suggestions about what needs to be done there in terms of kind of balancing out the corporate spending?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this report, CAP has always made, and this report makes recommendations that we really do need to be putting far greater amount of public dollars into clean energy research and development, not just at the early research and development stage, but also through to commercialization and deployment. One thing that we've seen historically has been that the federal government will put money into early stage research and development, like at the federal labs and in some of these university partnerships and public universities, but will not do much funding at the sort of commercialization stage or what's called the Valley of Death. There are several federal programs that we've at CAP at least have supported that we're strongly supportive of that try to do that. The ARPA-E program within the Department of Energy, the idea of a green bank that would actually provide some more independent financing for commercialization and deployment of clean energy. We clearly need to ramp up in this area. We are, as a country, falling farther and farther behind. And even with the infusion of the private dollars that we have had, we are at risk in the global clean energy economy. So there's a clear need for the types of programs that the Department of Energy and actually the USDA has done on clean energy for some kind of a green bank and ultimately just for a game change in the way we think about energy in this country, where we start to price carbon-intensive energy much more closely to its actual impact, and we start to even the playing field for clean energy.
There's a pretty indicative chart in the report. I'm not sure exactly what page it's on, but it compares how much we're spending in terms of national R&D on national defense, health, energy, and general science space technology. And, you know, you'll see that energy is just this tiny, tiny, infinitesimal little thread down at the bottom. So I think we clearly have to reorient our research priorities. You know, I don't know what it's going to take.
Next question.
The next question comes from Jack Stripling with Insider Higher Ed.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. Mine's a little more technical, and I just wonder if you can help explain how some of these research apparatuses work once they're in place. There's mention in the report, and you may expound on this somewhere in the report that I haven't seen, but where you were asking the question about does the university side retain the majority control of the alliance's central governing body? What would be a central governing body in a research relationship, and how does the division of control effect, what types of decisions would be made by this body? And can you explain that a little more technically?
Right. No, it's an excellent question. Yeah, that's why I stressed at the beginning that in some ways these deals are a new kind of energy research alliance that we're seeing on campus. Again, there's been a lot of examples of this in the pharmaceutical sector, but when you have a multi-year deal with a corporation, sometimes it's one sponsor, sometimes it's a group of sponsors, there has to be some kind of governing body that controls the new research alliance that has been formed. And so that's what's quite unusual about these, is that they require the university to set up new administrative governing structures so that they can oversee this alliance in tandem with the corporate sponsor or sponsors. And that's why I think it's so critical that these research contracts have better safeguards and protections in place. Do you see that there, in the case of UC Berkeley, let's just point to the Energy Biosciences Institute at Berkeley. There you have BP and the university have split the voting power on that governing body. It's called the Governance Board, and it was created just to oversee the Energy Biosciences Alliance. They have a separate governing body that deals with overseeing the day-to-day operations of the academic research that's funded by BP. The executive committee is charged with sort of making the first cuts of when it comes to evaluating faculty research proposals each new grant cycle. The executive committee weighs in on which proposals they think are the best. And there is an example where the contract does not require any kind of independent peer review. Peer review is never mentioned in the contract. But UC Berkeley says that they are using a competitive peer review process. And I tried to understand a little bit more carefully what that actually looks like. And the people who run the program actually admitted that the faculty select a certain number of proposals, and some of those proposals are sent out for some technical review by outside experts. But it is certainly not what we would consider a traditional competitive peer review process of selection. In any case, then, once that executive committee chooses which proposals they think are most are most meritorious, then those are forwarded to the governance board. And BP, which controls half of the votes, has to approve any projects that are funded. So that's an example of one area where the governance board would come in, would be final selection of research proposals. But general oversight of the and administration of the overall operations of the EBI are under the control of the governance board.
Well, so how does the, I mean, a quick follow-up. So how does it differ from... I mean, on a smaller scale, I guess we're used to, a professor or a group of professors doing a very finite project for industry. In this case, these large partnerships are formed that require a different administrative apparatus, and you're saying essentially BP might be in the position to read five proposals, and while you haven't claimed they've done this, they might be in a position to say, well, we like the proposal that's most favorable to our business interests as opposed to the one that maybe has the greatest value intellectually. Is that the concern here?
Yeah, I think the concern is on a number of levels. I mean, one is you have this very strong and longstanding tradition in universities that internal governing affairs should be controlled by the university. You know, we refer to it as academic self-governance. And universities talk about that all the time. They don't want the federal government to come in and intervene in their own internal academic affairs when they get grants from the federal government. And in the same way, I think that you have a problem here when universities are establishing long-term research relationships with outside corporate sponsors, but they're not insisting on academic control over the governance of those research alliances. We expect the university to perform independent research, and we expect the evaluation process will be one that makes sure that the process is fair, it's impartial, it's based on scientific merit. And my concern is that at the EBI there aren't enough safeguards for that, and because so many of the people who sit on the executive committee are themselves recipients of BP EBI funding. You run it, certainly. Those people are less likely to be as objective in evaluating and judging other faculty research. Let's say I'm working on a particular biofuels project. I'm going to be reluctant to award funding to someone who might have a more critical approach that contradicts my way of looking at the problem. So I think it's very important that you eliminate conflicts of interest on those bodies, particularly if this is an alliance that is structured to last 10 years.
Okay.
Did I answer that well enough? Do you want?
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out how this differs from. I mean, industry has been funding academic research for a long time, and I'm trying to figure out how this differs. I assume that. I mean, this has certainly come up in the pharmaceutical industry that people are concerned that, any single professor who receives money from pharmaceutical industry would do research on their behalf. I'm trying to figure out if there's a distinction with these governing bodies that makes this different.
I think the scale, the duration of these deals certainly makes it very different. Let's say you have a problem that should arise. If it only involves one lab and one researcher, that's a far cry from a situation that is much more of an institutionalized relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you know, the scale and duration of these deals makes this particularly important that you make it very clear the academic lines of authority. But, you know, you're absolutely right that university industry deals exist at various different in various different forms. And I think it's equally problematic, for instance, that we're seeing in pharmaceutical funding of clinical research that increasingly the drug companies are allowed to control the raw data related to the academic research investigation. I mean, universities should not permit the corporate sponsor to control the raw data. So that's an example of where there could be much better standards on, you know, smaller scale university industry contracting as well. And people, you know, certainly science journal articles have investigated that and are pointing that out. So I do think there's something distinctive about the size and duration of these deals, and it's all the more incumbent on the university to make sure that its academic mission is protected. But this is also true of smaller industry deals that probably could have better contracting as well.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Next question comes from Amanda DeBard, the Energy Guardian.
I'm trying to put this into a historical perspective. I mean, when you were doing your research, did you find evidence in which oil companies controlled the type of research universities could do or suppressed some of the university's findings?
Well, we really are looking at it. We don't know whether any research has been suppressed in these instances, right? We wouldn't be able to know that because we're looking at the contract that governs the research relationship. I don't know of any high profile cases that have come to light. We've certainly seen a lot of problems. Again, one of the areas of university industry relationships that's been most intensely scrutinized by outside parties is really the medical pharmaceutical arena. So we do know of many, many examples where drug companies have, in fact, you know, tried to suppress research. So we know that has been a problem. But I don't know of particular examples of that in this arena. I should say that it's difficult to get that kind of information. We don't always know when something's been buried.
Oh, was this Kate?
That was Jennifer.
Oh, sorry. That this was Jennifer. Yeah, Washburn.
Okay.
Next question.
Okay. The next question comes from Emily Badger with Miller McCool.
The reaction from some of these universities, did they all pick you up on your offer to comment on this? Did they generally dispute your concerns? And did you get any sort of sense from any of them that they felt like they didn't have the power to leverage these contracts the way they wanted to?
On the first question, we did not hear back from all 10 alliances. In the Texas example, again, just as they had the first time, they sent the request from us to the Attorney General, who denied basically our request for comment. I believe we did not hear back from the Colorado School of Mines, but I think, Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong, that we heard back from the other 8.
I think that's right. Eight of the 10 did respond.
And, you know, there were a number of specific comments, most of which are reflected, actually, in the final report in the appendices for each university. But to just generalize about responses, we did hear back from a number of especially the universities, that they were not happy with our characterization of the alliances based primarily on the contract language. Many of the universities felt that the practices that they actually use in governing the contracts or governing their relationships should have been examined, as well as the contract language itself. You know, we put that in the report and noted it, but said many times throughout the report, and we'll say here that that in these contracts, where really the only sort of publicly, in some cases publicly available, in some cases publicly gettable, contract, the only documentation available is the actual contract. That's the legally binding agreement language, and that regardless of whatever practices whoever happens to be governing the contract is putting in place, the contract language itself is what governs these agreements. That's the language that should stand, and that's the language that we examined. So we did reflect those comments in our final version, but we almost in no cases changed any of our final language.
Did you feel like that was answered?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
The next question comes from Laurel Rosenthal with Sacramento Bee.
I'm wondering if you could discuss why you believe government funding is really any better. I mean, when I talk to researchers at these universities, they say that, you know, when they do government research, that comes with its own agenda. There are biases there, too. So why do you think that having the government fund this kind of research is really any better or more independent than having the companies that are actually going to use the technologies do it?
This is Kate. That's a good question. I think a couple things, and Jennifer, I'm sure, will jump in. Number one, I would say when it's public funding, there tends to be a higher level of scrutiny. So it may be that the contracts are not that much more sort of balanced, but the scrutiny of the contracts is easier. It's easier to get copies of them. There tends to be more public process. So and there's more opportunity for the public to weigh in on the relationship. But a larger reason even than that, I think, and especially in this emerging energy field, you know, we pointed out earlier that most of the research that these agreements deal with is in biofuels, and that makes eminent sense because most of these companies are oil companies. When government does research, they don't come in with that kind of agenda. A government research contract would not necessarily be as aimed at a particular technology or a particular problem. Tends to be a little bit more open in terms of overall energy solutions to solve a larger social problem. So I'm interested, you know, in if we had the kind of government funding into these clean energy areas that, for instance, we had back during the oil crisis, would we see, and I think we would, a much broader range of technology research in a much broader range of energy sectors, rather than seeing this sort of spike in funding in a particular sector that happens to be one of interest to the companies with the most money in the energy field.
Yeah, I really second everything that Kate just said. I'll give it a little bit more of an historical perspective. I mean, I think anybody who is an expert on scientific innovation and the whole kind of innovation process, and many people in industry will absolutely acknowledge this, that university research tends to be very distinct from private sector research, and the reason for that is the government funding, and so. So why is that government funding important? It's because it tends to be the government tends to be more willing to fund really kind of more fundamental research. I'm not going to call it basic because basic implies that it doesn't have a particular application. I'm talking about research that may not have short-term commercial viability. But is incredibly important, promising research that may open up new pathways for new technologies to emerge. So we saw that the biotechnology revolution was born out of academic labs with public funding. We saw that the computer revolution was also born almost exclusively out of public research funding at federal labs and at universities. So we could fully expect, just from the history of innovation in this country, that the next really cutting-edge research that could take us to a whole new direction with clean energy could emerge out of academic labs and probably and very likely might emerge out of some of this publicly funded research that allows researchers greater flexibility. So you're right that some researchers will say, well, you know, there are stipulations attached to government funding as well that I have to conform to, and that's absolutely true. But most government funding is still dispersed through rigorous peer review process, and that is another distinctive attribute of that funding. So I think for all those reasons, and not to mention the fact that government funding tends to allow the research to be freely disseminated. One of the things I look at in this report, which is a very important part of it, is to what extent are the industry sponsors requiring exclusive commercial access to the results of this academic-funded research, academic research. And we found that overwhelmingly the industry sponsors want to very tightly control any you know, patentable or viable inventions that come out of this research. They want to be able to exclusively control the commercial rights to it. And so that's a very important distinction as well. If research that comes out of, if all research that came out of universities was tightly controlled by one company that way, obviously it would greatly greatly restrict and inhibit scientific innovation, because science is always about building on the shoulders of others. Any scientist will tell you that that public, broadly disseminated research is very important for the innovation process.
Okay, thanks.
Next question comes from Chris Holly with the Energy Daily.
Hi. I'm wondering if any of these contracts that you examined carried an abundance of the concerns you raised. You mentioned the Chevron contract. What university was that with, for example?
We actually looked at a couple of universities that were partnering with Chevron, and one thing that was interesting was how similar all the agreements were. That was sort of another indication that since the agreement between Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech, and Chevron, the agreement between Texas A&M and Chevron, UC Davis and Chevron, it's almost as if they used a Chevron template contract to negotiate those deals. There was a high degree of parallel. I'm not saying they were identical. There were quite distinctive differences, and that's an indication of presumably where the university stepped in and said, you know what, we're not happy with such an extensive delay on publications. Mm-hmm. So we're going to insist on so that's kind of interesting. For instance, the Chevron deal, I'm looking at the chart on page 52. The Chevron deal with Texas A&M University allows Chevron to delay publications for 365 days. I'm so sorry. That's Chevron with Colorado School of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
That contract allowed delays of literally 1 year, which is really unprecedented, and many universities would frown on such a long commercial delay, because publications are really the life of the university, and fast dissemination of knowledge is very important. So other contracts with Chevron had much shorter delays, and that's an indication clearly that the university put up insisted on a better deal. In terms of agreements, I mean, the agreement that I look at most closely in the report is the BP funded Energy Biosciences Institute, which I keep saying is at Berkeley, but it's also at the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. There are three partnering publicly funded research institutions: UC Berkeley, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. That's a deal that I was able to look more deeply at that deal. So I guess I would point to that one as a place to look. It also is very unusual because it allows BP to set up a proprietary research lab directly inside of the academic building. That houses the Energy Biosciences Institute. Now, Berkeley will tell you that there have been other examples of that, but I think mostly they've been off campus, and they've certainly been very, very minimal. That's very unusual for a publicly funded research institution to allow a company to set up a proprietary lab in the heart of an academic research building, and I think that's a pretty disturbing precedent.
We have time for one last question.
So. Okay, go ahead. I'll give someone else a shot. Thank you.
Next question is from Brian Walsh with the Time Magazine.
When you you know, when you would speak to, these university alliances and they would tell you, well, you know, the language of the contract may say one thing, we really act in the real world in a different way. I mean, did they give me a sense why that is? I mean, why don't they change that? Why didn't they insist on contract language that more closely fits what they apparently want to do in the real world? Why is there that distance, I guess?
Kate, do you want to have any speculation on that?
I don't. It's a good question. It's a question I've often asked myself. Jennifer, did you dig in on that at all with your responses?
You know, I am a little perplexed by it. I mean, I think something like competitive peer review, for example, I do find it strange that the two institutions where we saw a real discrepancy, some of the institutions do not require any kind of independent peer review in their contracts. Well, all of the contracts did not even mention peer review. Some of them that don't mention peer review went, for instance, Iowa State University, I talked to them about their process. It's quite clear that ConocoPhillips puts out the RFP, the request for proposals, and ConocoPhillips staff basically choose, one could argue, sort of cherry-pick whichever faculty research proposals they find of most interest to them. So they're quite clearly, there's a sort of, you know, consistency. But at Stanford University and at UC Berkeley, they did, in interviews, I determined that they do have some kind of informal peer review process that they're using. At Berkeley, I found a lot of problems with it, as I've already sort of mentioned, and that's discussed in various sections of the report, particularly the appendices section and the conflict of interest section. But I don't think they have a very good argument for why something as important as peer review or the question of how faculty research proposals will be fairly selected, I don't think they have a very good explanation for that I've heard for why that's not in the contract.
It is a really good question, though. You know, I'm a lawyer, and all I can say is if I had a client entering into a multi-million-dollar deal with my with a corporation, I would want to make sure that all the stuff that I wanted to happen was reflected in that deal in the written language. So that's why we looked at the written language.
And with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up. Again, thank you all for attending the call. If you have follow-up questions, again, my name is Anna Solner. My phone number is 202-478-5322. That's 202-478-5322. You can find Big Oil online at AmericanProgress.org. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you to Kate and to Jennifer.
Thanks, Anna.